Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. When the COVID state of emergency in California ended this year, so did the emergency allotment of food assistance. And some would argue that the additional CalFresh benefits are still needed amid a time when inflation is straining food banks' capacity to help everyone in need. And the difference in the amount a person received during the pandemic for groceries to now can be staggering. Joining us to discuss the challenges CalFresh recipients and food banks are facing is CAP Radio healthcare reporter Kate Wolf. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning, Vicky.
So this CalFresh emergency allotment, it ended at the end of March after really 3 years of recipients receiving at least an additional $95 a month increase. So we're now 6 weeks or so out. How are recipients adjusting to these changes?
So the emergency allotment program was a federal policy, and it ended with the Consolidated Appropriations Act, which was signed into law at the end of last year. So folks have known for a few months, although about one in five CalFresh recipients do speak English as a second language, so that presents its own challenges. As for how people prepared, I think that it ranges. I spoke with Heidi Bergdahl, who is disabled and on Social Security. I met her in the parking lot of Arcade Church up in the Arden Arcade area, where she was at a food bank distribution. She was getting $23 in benefits before the pandemic, and with the emergency allotments, she started getting $260 a month. It made a huge difference in her life.
It's more than tenfold.
Yes, and it really made it so that she could shop at her neighborhood store. She had more flexibility. She could buy more nutritious options. And since she found out that these benefits were going to be ending, she's been stockpiling food. She's been buying meat to fill her freezer. She's been going to the food bank. And she says she's kind of running out of room a little bit in her apartment because she has all these dry goods boxes. She knows that, and they won't last forever. So this is what she said to me.
Between losing the pandemic money, the increase in rent, the increase in grocery costs, you know, it's going to be a juggling act, you know, making sure I get the best value for my money. And at some point, it may take me a year, but I'm going to go through all the stuff I've been picking up here. And I'll keep coming as long as they're doing this, because it is saving me money.
And this comes at a time when inflation is at a 40-year high. So, I mean, we're talking about in this woman's case, in Heidi's case, I mean, it's just a fraction of what Heidi was receiving per month, from $260 a month to $23 a month. Now we have inflation. So are CalFresh benefits being adjusted to reflect the price increases that we're all seeing at the store?
They are not. A lot of folks on Social Security received a cost of living adjustment this year. So there are other federal programs that are changing slightly. CalFresh, more broadly, SNAP food benefits, because CalFresh is part of SNAP, which is the federal food aid policy. CalFresh has not changed, and that's a big problem. According to the food bank, which says, you know, we go to the store, $23 barely gets you a gallon of milk, a carton of eggs, and a loaf of bread nowadays. So the food bank is asking the state to adjust that minimum from $23 to $50, but Governor Gavin Newsom didn't include that in his revised May budget that was just revealed last week.
Okay. Another arm of this that's also really important are food banks, right? You met Heidi at a food bank. One of the big ones in our area is the Sacramento Food Bank and Family Services. How has demand changed over the last few years?
So I spoke with Kevin Buffalino, who's the communications manager for the Sacramento Food Bank and Family Services, and he said that in its 47-year history, the food bank and its partners have only fed 300,000 people a handful of times. So that was twice during the holidays in 2020, and again this past March when people understood that the allotments were going to be ending, and so they rushed to the food bank, I think, to make sure that they could get more food, stock up a little bit.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so CalFresh allotments have definitely been part of the strain on food banks, but they're not all. So here's what he said.
In 2019, pre-COVID, we were serving about 150,000 people a month. That jumped up to that 300,000 during COVID, kind of started to slide back towards 200,000 in early 2022. And then inflation started going up and we saw our numbers go up with it. So a number of factors, it's not just emergency allotments. Inflation is playing a big part into this as well.
Yeah, and they also buy things at wholesale oftentimes as well. So they're impacted by inflation as well as seeing the impact of inflation by having to serve more people. A food bank also can be limited, and there are individuals that have dietary restrictions. They have medical conditions like diabetes. How are they managing during this time?
So the food bank hooked me up with someone named Tom McSpadden. He's a 69-year-old resident in Citrus Heights, and they helped him get reassessed for CalFresh benefits. So that he wasn't only making, you know, $50 a month. Instead, he now gets $124 a month. He has type 2 diabetes, and he's on a significantly reduced diet with this $124 a month. He's really struggling. He goes to the store at the beginning of the week, he says, and he buys a loaf of bread, a pound of ham, and it makes him, makes his food for him throughout the week. So he says he has two pieces of toast in the morning. He waits till mid-afternoon to have a few sandwiches and chips, has a big glass of milk before bed. He's trying to make it all work with his insulin levels, but he's definitely struggling. And I thought it was important to talk to him because even though the food bank is helping so many people, there are a lot of people who forego it.
Even though I have to eat bread, and in order to survive, I'm trying to still do my best, and I'm not going to take a box away from the food bank. I'm not going to feel good about bringing a box of food home and eating four or five items out of that box, and the rest of it I'm just going to sit there and I'm not going to eat it. Where mm-hmm. somebody else can use that, especially a family.
So I don't know if this is exactly Tom's situation, but there is a little bit of a misconception about the food bank that it, is only providing super calorie dense options and it won't have the right food for you. But when I went to the food bank, people could get protein sources like fish sticks, and there was produce like oranges, onions, potatoes. There's lots of good stuff. And I think food banks have begun to realize that, I have been realizing probably for a while now that that there is, it's good to have a bunch of different options for a bunch of different people. And in June, the food bank is going to go switch to a more farmer's market type situation where you can pick what you need, what you like, what fits within your diet. They do that in all sorts of partner agencies around Sacramento County, but that's going to be more of a focus.
Mm. And for those who are unfamiliar, what he was talking about the box is that traditionally you wouldn't really get to pick what you wanted, right? You essentially get a box of goods, of foods.
Exactly. Yes. So you do still get a box of dried goods. But I think that, there's more variety than maybe he expected to.
Hmm. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio healthcare reporter Kate Wolfe about the loss of additional food benefits during the pandemic and the impact on food banks. How is the Sacramento Food Bank and Family Services working to ensure funding and support from the state of California when we have a budget deficit? And as you just mentioned, the governor didn't include it in his May revise.
The organization is huge. It has a lobbying arm to go and ask for the things they need. In early May, food banks met with legislators to campaign for all sorts of different hunger and anti-poverty related bills. They also are advocating for more funding. They're really doing all they can to save food that will go to waste, to source food in all sorts of different spaces. But they buy 60% of their food. So they really need an infusion of state support now that the support that they're giving to the community has doubled.
Yeah. How is the state responding to food insecurity outside of not including or increasing the need or the CalFresh benefits to essentially compensate for inflation in the state budget as it stands now?
So, yes, there was some good information coming from the May revise to the state budget that was unveiled last week. On the bright side, there's been a $60 million investment in food banks buying and distributing California-grown foods. And there were a slew of investments in providing school meals for all and summer help for next year and theft protection. So a lot of stuff, laying the groundwork for a lot of stuff, anticipating that the food banks will continue needing this much aid. Going forward, the food banks were not totally pleased with everything in the May revised budget. There's still, you know, there's still time for these things to get worked out. The budget has not been finalized. And so they're still asking for that $23 to $50 minimum benefit increase. They're still asking for $180 in aid to expand capacity. And but as you know, as we've explored, there is a $31.5 billion deficit the governor is trying to work out. Huge balancing act, and not everyone can get what they want.
Right. There's also the federal component to this. CalFresh is part of SNAP, and that's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. That is also shaped by, you know, political winds in Congress. We have a debt ceiling that is in limbo. How can this potentially impact food benefits federally, and what conversations are taking place?
So as we've been hearing on NPR this morning and kind of in the past couple of days, that's really a sticking point right now. So legislation passed by the House in April, pushed by Republicans, would impose new or expanded work requirements for federal programs, including SNAP. Currently, people who are on SNAP who are below 50 must work or participate in a job training program at least 20 hours a week to receive those benefits. And this new proposal to save money for the federal government would increase those requirements to people 50 to 55. So it would include people in that age range, too. So that is something that seems like is definitely still in conversation to be figured out on the federal level. Huge pushback, though, when this was proposed from food banks who said they're already experiencing unprecedented strain. If it's harder for people to access SNAP, if it's harder for people to access CalFresh, that's just going to add to their strain. It's going to be, you know, more difficult for those people to get CalFresh benefits. So they're going to go to the food bank.
What other programs and food resources are available in the interim?
So CalFresh will match some of what you spend. If you're signed up for CalFresh, they'll match some of what you spend at farmers markets in Sacramento, Midtown Farmers Market, at Capitol Mall, West Sac, Arden area, all over the county. And there's also a new program. If you're a senior in South Sacramento, there's something called the People to Produce Project, which shuttles people to the Florin Road Farmers Market and brings them back to a community center in Meadowview, provides a $20 voucher to use on local produce. And also, if you are getting CalFresh and you think and your situation has changed from the beginning of the pandemic to now, you can get reassessed, you know, and the food bank will help you with that. So if you call the food bank and family services, they'll help you get reassessed. That's also a great option for people.
Yeah, a lot of news you can use. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks so much.
That is CAP Radio healthcare reporter Kate Wolf discussing the end of pandemic food benefits and the impacts on recipients as well as food banks who are working to help those affected by food insecurity. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Reducing waste, or even zero waste, is a growing goal in the pursuit of reducing harm to the environment and climate. From composting to rethinking single-use products and sustainable fashion, these feats are gaining more mainstream attention. One of the latest trends includes a popular California crop, almond upcycling. The process focuses on repurposing the hull of an almond, which is the fleshy fruit similar to a peach or a cherry, into fiber-rich ingredients that can be used in nutrition bars, tea, possibly beer, and more. Dr. Josette Lewis is the chief scientific officer for the Almond Board of California, which supports all 7,600 almond growers in the state. The work is in partnership with Matson. That's a food science company based in the Bay Area. We're going to hear from them in just a moment. But first, we welcome Dr. Lewis to Insight. Good morning.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Okay. So, Josette, I am very grateful that I got an image of everything that surrounds an almond that we all enjoy. So let's break down the layers of an almond. Starting off, what is the part that we enjoy eating?
So the almond kernel is in the inside of what looks a bit like a peach pit. So again, using that analogy that almonds are very closely related to peaches and apricots and cherries. The almond, the kernel inside, is surrounded by a shell. Now, in an almond compared to a peach, you could crack the shell with your hands. It's very, very soft. It's pretty woody. And then surrounding that, now we're outside the pit of a peach, you have the fleshy part. And in an almond, that's called the hull. And it's very similar to a peach when it's first developing. But then in an almond compared to a peach, we let it dry out over the course of the summer. In fact, growers hold back some water to really accelerate the drying process because that makes the hull split open and easier to get the almonds out on the inside.
Why can't you eat or wouldn't want to eat the fruity, fleshy part like a peach or a cherry of an almond?
Well,
I would imagine it tastes differently if you just ate it like biting into a peach.
When we started this project, I in fact did that. I took some almond hulls and soaked them in water to get a little more moisture back in there and tasted it. It's much thinner than a peach, not quite as fleshy. So it's still it's a little bit more leathery, but it doesn't have an unpleasant taste.
No, and it's currently being repurposed, which is
right.
The focus of this conversation. I also learned that, you know, when it comes to almond being a nut, it's actually more complicated than that.
Right. The technical term is almond is a drupe, which is the botanical name for that part of the plant, as opposed to a walnut, which is for a true nut, or a peanut, which is actually in some parts of the world called a ground nut because it's not a true nut either.
Hmm. So when it comes to this fleshy part of the almond, you mentioned that farmers will intentionally dry out the hull. So what is it used for typically?
Well, right now it is fed to dairy cows here in the state of California. It does have sugars in it, so it has a really pleasant taste to the cows. Some people call it cow candy. And it has fibers and phytonutrients that are good for dairy feed. So all of the hulls currently go into the dairy industry, and that has a really important environmental benefit to the state. It reduces the amount of alfalfa that is needed to grow for dairy feed by about 400,000 acres. And if you think about the amount of water that would be needed to grow that alfalfa, it's enough water that could provide about 2 million households for a year of water here in the state of California. So by upcycling those hulls already into the dairy industry, we already reduce the environmental footprint of food here in the state of California.
So what led to this latest attempt to upcycle an almond hull, the discarded part of the almond that goes to cattle, for humans to actually enjoy, for it to be ingredients in food?
There's a few motivations there. One is that we'd like to add more value back into the industry in the Central Valley. The dairy industry is a very important part of the Central Valley here in California. We are the number one dairy state in the nation. Not everyone realizes that. I think most people think of Wisconsin. But we're looking to add more value to that product. Dairy feed is not always a very lucrative way of using it, so it adds more value if we can find higher quality uses. And also to add, there's increasing interest in the Central Valley in adding more jobs based on processing of these co-products that come out of agriculture. We've started a really nice partnership with Stanislaus County, which is in the Lodi to Modesto area, to try to attract more companies to the region that are developing all sorts of different types of products from what was once called waste from agriculture, but we think can be upcycled and used for higher value products. And that adds new manufacturing and better quality jobs in the Central Valley as well.
You, can you remind us how big the almond industry is in California? I mean, I led with there's, you know, over 7,000 almond farmers in the state. And that's just one piece, right? Because you have beekeepers, you have other arms that are connected to the industry.
Absolutely. Well, we're really proud that those 7,600 almond growers are mostly family farms. Over 90% of those are family farms. And 70% of them are actually farming less than 100 acres. So we have a lot of small, very traditional family farms in this industry, which is a great asset because it keeps a lot of rural towns and cities very vibrant. Those people live on their farms and they're part of their communities. We are the largest crop acreage here in California, about 1.6 million acres of almonds. That's because this is the ideal climate for growing almonds. California is the largest Mediterranean climate in the world, and almonds need enough cold weather in the winter to make the trees go dormant. They sort of go to sleep for a little while. And then we have to have springs that aren't super cold because the almond tree blooms really early around Valentine's Day. And we need the temperatures to be a little warmer for the beekeepers for the bees to come out and pollinate the crop. So we are the largest crop in the state and we grow most of the world's almonds.
Hmm. So having a concept is one thing. How did you and your team at the Almond Board begin kind of testing this idea? And you touched upon this, but I would imagine like one of the first steps or maybe the first step is actually reaching out to almond farmers, you know, telling them about the idea and seeing if they're interested.
Yeah, well, we're really lucky that everything we do at the Almond Board is overseen and decisions are made by people from within our industry because we really represent and invest their dollars on behalf of them. So we had a committee of folks who really wanted to look at how we could diversify the use of almond co-products and create more value back for the industry. And that committee helped us oversee a lot of different research over the last years. We start out by looking at what's in the almond hull, for example? What is the composition? And, you know, we know there's sugars in there, there's fibers, there's these phytonutrients. So we start out with some projects seeing how you could extract the sugars from almond hulls and maybe use that as a food ingredient, which is very possible to do. It's feasible. But it's not very economically competitive. So getting a sugar out of hulls versus sugar beets or sugar cane or any of the other ways in which that ingredient is made, it's not economically competitive. So then we started looking at how you could treat the hulls to maybe use the hull itself as a whole ingredient, looking at how to make it into a powdered form that would be more compatible as an ingredient. And take advantage of the whole package of what's in that hull.
Yeah. When it comes to the hull and the ratio of the opportunity that can be made from this waste, what is the hull compared to what is actually used and sold currently, the almond kernel or the seed, right?
Right. So the hulls are about twice the weight of the kernel, the nut that we eat. This year, we just got our estimate. The U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates we'll have 2.5 billion pounds of kernels of the nuts this year. We'll see if that plays out. So that would be about 5 billion pounds of hulls.
That's a lot of opportunity.
It is, indeed.
How, when it comes to the process, you know, because now you're kind of in the thick of it, right? And it's in its infancy. But, you know, how has this upcycling process of reducing waste, how has it been going?
Well, it is some pretty exciting opportunities that we could even taste today. So as you mentioned, Mattson has been working with us to develop food product concepts. They started out by tasting the hulls themselves, figuring out what sort of the flavor profiles were and how those might be compatible with different other ingredients. And couple of winning opportunities that we can talk about with them today is the idea of using powdered almond hulls as an ingredient in a nutritional bar, like a Clif Bar type product, adds a lot of really valuable nutrition into that product and has a good flavor. Hmm. So we've also tried coffee using...
What does that do?
So almond hulls have a flavor profile that has a bit of bitterness as well as some sweetness, so compatible with coffee. And they roasted the almond hulls and then used it as a partial substitute for coffee beans or as a full substitute, making sort of a almond fruit tea that has a similar flavor to coffee. So as someone who needs to moderate their caffeine intake, I got pretty excited about maybe a 20% replacement of my coffee beans with almond hulls, and I could maybe have an extra cup of coffee a day.
Yeah, that's just like the tip of the iceberg, right? Because there's so many combinations that you can have, from flavor profiles to how it interacts with other ingredients, as well as in what conditions, what would be prime for an almond hull. So that's really fascinating. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're learning about almond upcycling, which repurposes the hull of an almond, hoping to turn it into a fiber-rich ingredient for foods and beverages. So we're now going to bring in the food science company that is behind reimagining what an almond tree can do. Al Banish is the Chief Strategy and Client Engagement Officer, and Willem Duckworth is the Product Development Technician. They both work for Matson, that is a food science company based in the Bay Area. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Vicky.
Morning, Vicky.
All right, Al, I want to start off with you. What does Matson do? How do people see your work in the products that they actually eat and drink?
Yeah, I mean, we like to say Matson invents the future of food. We are a 45-year-old food and beverage innovation firm here in the Bay Area, and we work with... We work throughout the food industry in creating both new products and, in this case, higher value uses for co-products like almond hulls.
Hmm. When the almond board turned to you and talked about the prospect of turning an almond hull into an ingredient that can be used in food products, you know, mm-hmm. what was exciting about this prospect, given that, you know, you've been doing this now as a company for over 40 years?
Yeah. It's interesting, just connecting the dots. The last segment touched upon food insecurity. And despite that insecurity, as you know, we as Americans waste so many tons and tons and tons of food. And part of that is not utilizing or underutilizing co-products like almond hulls. So we get very excited about opportunities to address some of those food insecurity opportunities. And we do a lot of work in upcycling co-products like almond hulls. As we get into this, you know, that we go through a process whereby we evaluate the potential of that co-product nutritionally, functionally, hedonically. In other words, what is it going to do for flavor? What is it going to do for texture and so forth? And then when it came to almond hulls, one of the things we discovered is that the hull is a good source of dietary fiber, and Americans consume less than half the fiber they should on average. So we saw opportunities there. We evaluated the hulls in terms of what they might do functionally. Would they bind? Would they gel? Would they emulsify and so forth? And then, as Josette said, we evaluated the hulls in terms of what they might do from a flavor perspective. And we really keyed in on this slight bitter, fruity flavor profile. And that's where Willem and the team went to work and found some applications.
All right, Willem, well, that brings you in. So peel back the curtain for us. Behind all the trial and error that goes into creating a food or a beverage product that's really sustainable but also tasty.
Yeah, so I think first we tried to identify the strengths. So like Al and Josette mentioned, it's mostly fiber. So that's one area of opportunity we identified for exploration, as well as the flavor. So in terms of the flavor for the almond hull beverage, we found that when we roasted it, similar to green coffee beans, and then ground them, again, similar to ground coffee, the flavor was pleasant, mostly of dried fruit, like almost like a raisin, and it was acidic up front like coffee with a bitter finish. In terms of fiber for the nutrition bar, which we feel is a pretty strong proof of concept, we used it to boost the fiber. We created a bar that had twice the fiber of our reference product that was on the market already. And we chose a coconut chocolate flavored bar because that flavor was enhanced by the almond hull's inherent flavor.
Given that you have been behind a lot of products, you're a product development technician for Matson. What stands out to you about this particular project, repurposing or upcycling parts of an almond that we, as far as humans are concerned, don't typically consume?
Well, that's a great question. I think upcycling mainly, like Al mentioned, is a really a great opportunity to use ingredients that might otherwise not be used to improve our food waste issue that we have here in this country. And honestly, I think the best part about this was the flavor and finding out kind of how it fit and how it worked. That's my favorite part. I have a culinary background, so I love just finding great flavor combinations and how flavor can work well in tandem with others. Mm.
And you mentioned a nutrition bar, but are there other ways that you're currently thinking that Almond Holes can also be successful?
Well, we did explore a couple of other proof of concepts. So that's the coffee extender, which adds a bit of complexity to our just general coffee. It also mutes bitterness in some cases. We also explored bread, but we found that that didn't work too well texturally. The flavor was pretty good. The Almond Holes did impart a decent flavor in a whole wheat bread, but the texture wasn't as desired.
I would imagine there's a good amount of learning curves in a process like this.
Absolutely. We did so many, we had so many ideas. Actually, we had an internal brainstorming session. We had like 50 plus ideas for applications. We really narrowed it down to just a few that we felt had the most promise to focus in there.
Al, I think a bigger trend or a bigger shift maybe in our social consciousness is this desire from a consumer standpoint to have sustainability, to have reduced waste, to have upcycling. I mean, this is vocabulary that is being used more regularly. You know, what are larger conversations that are that you're having at Matson? Because this is one piece of a larger shift that's taking place not only in California, but across the country.
Well, it definitely is. We did a survey in 2021 in which 70% of Americans said they see food waste as an issue. 54% of people said they'd heard the term upcycling, but we know that they didn't really, most didn't really understand what that was. So there's a great deal of opportunity to better communicate this this idea. There is now an upcycled certification program, and we're seeing more and more products in the supermarket with this certification that indicates that a food is made with upcycled ingredients. And hopefully we'll see more and more of those products with upcycled Almond Holes as an example. Mm. But still, I think the awareness is still low and the opportunity is very great. We've done work, again, not only with holes, but with everything from the barley from beer making to corn germ from the corn industry to trim in the cheese production industry and so forth. And there's just, you know, lots and lots of opportunity for more.
Yeah, it just seems like it's kind of just the beginning, right?
It is.
So, Josette, how has it been like going through the process and actually tasting a variety of potential products for better or for worse?
Well, we've definitely had our highs and our lows, as Willem and Matt and Al mentioned. The bread, if you love a good hearty German rye, maybe it was a good fit, but probably not mainstream for most folks.
Not as buoyant or, you know.
Right. You know, we would have loved the Holes to be a great emulsifier in almond butter. A nice chance to have almond plus almond. But that didn't pan out quite as well as we had hoped either. And the most recent example we had the opportunity to try was almond beer.
I was just going to ask that. Yeah. I read that in the Bakersfield, California. How did that turn out?
Well, mixed, I would say. So definitely, so the hulls were used in place of hops at various percentages. And I think at a partial replacement, it adds an interesting flavor to the beer. There's a lot of novelty in the craft beer industry these days. People who've had chocolate in their stouts and fruits in their IPAs. So I do think there's a real opportunity there. You know, probably not becoming huge industry, but I think breweries in the Central Valley might pick up that idea and really add a kind of local twist to their brewing. As you got further up to 100% replacement, it really wasn't like a beer product. Still had a great flavor. Personally, I thought it was a bit more – some folks thought it was like a hard kombucha or a sour – So interesting flavors, but definitely not qualified as beer at that point. So
essentially, would that be used in exchange for like hops?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Again, kind of reflecting on the flavor profile, as Mattson talked about, there's a fruitiness to it in addition to a little bit of a bitter flavor. So that's perfect match for hops, but has different performance and composition with respect to then what beer looks like mm-hmm. in the end. So it was a really fun afternoon at the Almond Board offices where we got to taste that. There is also commercial almond beer available. I saw some on tap in Davis, California, just a couple weeks ago that actually uses the kernel itself to add some flavor into the beer. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you can leave the taste stuff to the brewers, right? That's where they can be creative and have fun with it. So you did bring a sample. So what are we going to try first? This is a nutrition bar?
Yeah. So as the folks at Mattson could probably add in, this is similar to a commercial bar that you could purchase today. Use the similar ingredients and production, and it has almond hulls as an ingredient in there. And as they mentioned, it's a sort of a coconut chocolate flavor profile.
I can smell it.
Go ahead and give it a taste.
Sorry, you don't have to hear me chew.
It
tastes really good. Yeah, it really just tastes like I would have no idea that there's an almond hull in this as an ingredient, and it's great that there's fiber in it as well.
Absolutely. You can, I think at this level of ingredient, you meet
a little chewy.
39% of your daily fiber requirement, which, as Al said, most Americans are not meeting. So that's a really big health advantage. And then it has half the effective carbohydrates in this bar compared to its counterpart without almond hulls. So that's another great health benefit for most of us who are watching our carbohydrate intake. Mm-hmm. So the first thing is it has to taste good. And as you said, it does.
Yeah, it does taste good. It tastes just like a nutrition bar. And that's great that it also has some really good health properties in there as well. When it comes to people actually being able to see them on store shelves, I mean, when do you think this could happen?
Well, we are finishing up the research to show that almond hulls, or almond fruit, as we may call it, are a safe food to eat. So we expect next year to get hopefully recognition from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to show that this is a safe food ingredient. It doesn't add any new allergens into your food supply that you didn't anticipate, for example. And then at that point, we'll really reach out to the food industry a lot more actively because they will want to know that that is not a hurdle that they have to go over themselves. So hopefully within the next few years, that would be something we could see on our shelves and enjoy the fruits of California as well as the nuts of California.
All right, Al, I want to end with you because you said something that's really important, that there isn't enough awareness about reducing waste or repurposing ingredients or upcycling from a consumer standpoint. What would you like listeners to take away from this conversation? Because we all got to eat, right? And we all got to buy food.
Yeah. I guess I would just want anyone who's listening to be open-minded to this idea of consuming foods that are made with some of these nutritious, flavorful, co-products that otherwise, might go to landfills or other less valuable uses. There'll be plenty of cow candy left over, even if we are very successful here. So the cows will be happy, but I think that we as humans can be happy as well.
The appetites of cows will not be harmed in the production of almond hull. So on that note, Josette, Al, and Willem, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thanks for the opportunity to talk with you today.
Thank you. Thanks.
Dr. Josette Lewis is the Chief Scientific Officer of the Almond Board of California. Al Banish is the Chief Strategy and Client Engagement Officer, joined by Willem Duckworth, the Product Development Technician. Both work for Mattson, a food science company based in the Bay Area. And they all are discussing almond upcycling, looking to repurpose the hull of an almond, hoping to turn it into a fiber-rich ingredient for foods and beverages. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
We'll be right back.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Tomorrow marks the end of an era for Jennifer Reason as she will end her 9-year run as artistic director of the Sacramento Vocal Ensemble, RSVP Choir. Thankfully, you can still catch Jennifer and her wonderful voice here on Cap Radio as our midday classical host. RSVP stands for Reconciliation Singers Voices of Peace. The ensemble started back in the early 2000s with really a singular goal of performing concerts in the Sacramento community to benefit local charities. And tomorrow night, Jennifer and her team at RSVP will perform a concert at the Westminster Presbyterian Church in Sacramento to benefit a cause that they are all very passionate about, music education. In fact, it will feature 4 local students who have benefited from music during their high school careers. And with that, we're joined by Cap Radio's Jennifer Reason, along with Allison Cagley, founder of Friends of Sacramento Arts. Good morning.
Good morning, Vicky. Good morning. Thanks for having us.
All right, what a treat. Okay, so Jennifer, talk to us about RSVP and how did this ensemble come together and how did you get involved?
Well, I love this ensemble with my whole heart. It's the most beautiful gathering of human beings. It was founded in 2000 by our founder, Julie Adams, who literally just had a dream one night that she thought we were going to sing for food. Literally to bring food to the homeless would be where the money went. And from there, it's expanded to all sorts of charities. And I heard them probably 17 years ago and said, oh my God, I'm singing with them. So I joined, I auditioned, I got in, and I've sang with them for 15 years before I took over the position.
You know, a lot of people might know you as a pianist.
Right.
But you also have a wonderful voice as well.
Thank you. Yeah.
How does it feel that you're going to be closing a chapter on something that was so special to you?
I mean, anything that is that impactful and that big of a time, I mean, it's a decade and a half. It's bittersweet, to say the very least. And it's been just the greatest gift of my life. So I'm feeling quite a number of things about it.
Yeah. Well, there's going to be a beautiful bow on it tomorrow for you. Yeah. I mean, this ends your run as the artistic director. And the concert is planned at the Westminster Presbyterian Church located in Sacramento. And you chose music education as the beneficiary of donations for this free concert. You know, what led to this kind of collaboration with the church and with the mission?
Well, Westminster is amazing in this community. They host all sorts of concerts. They have long-standing concert series. They're amazing supporters of the arts in general. But my thought was, well, my final charity, which is our 40th charity, actually, that RSVP has supported, like, well, if I'm stepping down, it makes sense to support the type of outreach that will pass the mantle, so to speak. It develops the next generation. So go kids.
Yeah. Well, Allison, I mean, that brings me to you because you are the executive director. You're also the founder of Friends of Sacramento Arts. What's the origin story?
So the origin story was the mayor and a number of community leaders back in 2018 did a study of arts and culture and the creative economy in Sacramento. And of that came the plan called the Creative Edge Culture Plan. And it's to really uplift the Sacramento region, to support the arts, to recognize a thriving economy, a thriving community, is thanks to the arts. And so the number one goal of that plan is restore arts education in public education, because 1 in 5 school children in California get arts. So 80% of our kids have no arts education in public school.
Wow. And that has so many benefits outside of being able to play an instrument or sing or express your creativity.
Yes, there are study after study, both national and statewide, on the academic benefits and on the social emotional benefits. If kids have arts, they're 4 times more likely to graduate, less likely to drop out. And especially now, after COVID and social isolation, the need to heal and the arts can provide that healing and that sense of community and wholeness that is irreplaceable.
Yeah, it's intangible. I mean, it's really special. So Jennifer, I mean, I would imagine music education has drastically shaped your life and obviously your career as well.
Absolutely. My mom was a music teacher, so we didn't really have a choice. I started when I was 4, but quickly realized that this was the best way for me to become a human. Sometimes I couldn't handle the emotions or couldn't handle the words or find the words to say, and music was absolutely always there.
So talk to us about really like the 4 potential stars of tomorrow night, these 4 high school students. How did this come about?
Well, I was thinking, gosh, if we're supporting arts education, why not highlight it being actively implemented? So I asked 4 incredibly talented high schoolers to join us. And one of the high schoolers actually wrote one of the songs. So I can't wait to feature that.
Yeah, and we're going to actually get a little preview of what people are going to be enjoying tomorrow night. Talk to us about the first piece that we're going to hear, Ave Maria.
Ave Maria. It's written by a young woman named Jessica Franchi. So part of my mission is to highlight all voices in music. So this is just a lovely a cappella prayer, if you will.
If you have trouble staying present, this is a great tool to stay
yes.
present.
Absolutely.
to zip it and just take it all in.
And just take a slow breath for once. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, it's wonderful and emotional, too.
Yeah, yes. Very.
So the next song is Flight Song.
Yes, Flight Song is really about this concert. It's about the power that music has to uplift you above all of these struggles and in a way that only music can.
I mean, we all took that in as an audience, but it can take your breath away, right, Allison?
Tears to my eyes.
How does it feel performing this?
Incredibly powerful. You can feel the audience kind of holding your breath and being right there with you, and you can feel the impact it's having.
Mm. You know, for your organization, Friends of Sacramento Arts, how integral are partnerships like this with the RSVP Choir?
Well, it's a multifaceted thing because you think about it's not only inspiring future singers and artists and musicians and fine artists and sculptors, but also the future patrons. And so being able to bring your whole family to concerts like this introduces children of all ages to the beauty of music that they may not have otherwise. And the concerts are free, so there's no reason that families of all capabilities can enjoy it.
Yeah. I mean, having it, incorporating it into a lifestyle.
Exactly.
You know, people may not be aware that they can do that when you say that 80% of children don't really have access to music education.
Exactly. And to be able to provide that sense of community and then with the students that are performing tomorrow night, the next generation of performers and patrons.
Hmm. So, Jennifer, for listeners who want to attend tomorrow night, you know, what are the FAQs, the details?
You show up at the church and you find a seat and you clap as loud as you can and then you donate to the charity.
That is wonderful. And it'll be, and you've already supported Friends of Sacramento Arts is the 40th.
The 40th.
Charity, which is just wonderful. When it comes to your organization, Allison, how can listeners get involved and learn more?
Yes, that's great. Well, as everybody is on social media, we have a great Facebook following, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And our website is friendsofsacramentoarts.org. And our vision is arts every day for every child in every school.
I like that.
Amen.
Yeah, amen to that.
Standing ovation.
I know that the chapter is closing for you, Jennifer, for RSVP Choir, but you are a very, very busy bee. You know, what else do you have planned to keep your creative juices going?
Well, obviously, I deeply love hosting classical music for our audience here. I'm also getting very involved with the Recording Academy and the Grammys, but on their advocacy side. So I'll be advocating for professional musicians in Congress. So I'm looking really forward to that.
That is the big leagues. Yeah. Jennifer and Allison, thank you so much for the
thank
time.
You,
thank you.
Wonderful voices and music. Mm. Jennifer Reason and Allison Cagley are talking to us about RSVP Choir. They are going to be having a free performance tomorrow. We have all of the information on our Insight page. And donations will go towards music education for youth in Sacramento. And with that, that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. Here is more of the RSVP Choir. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.